This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You probably don't know what our guest Billy West looks like, but you've almost certainly heard his voice. West is a vocal artist who's done everything from classic cartoon characters to celebrity impressions, and he's now featured in the revival of the animated TV series Futurama. Created by Matt Groening of The Simpsons, Futurama was canceled by Fox in 2003, but now it's back on Comedy Central, airing Thursday nights at 9. Besides playing several characters in Futurama, West has been the voices of Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd in the 1996 movie Space Jam, and played both Ren and Stimpy at various points in the Nickelodeon series. West's other roles include Popeye in the recent CGI film, Zim on the Nickelodeon show Invader Zim, and Doug Funny on the TV show Doug. From 1989 to 1995, he appeared regularly on The Howard Stern Show, imitating everyone from Mia Farrow and Leona Helmsley to Maury Povich and Elton John. I spoke to Billy West earlier this week. Well, Billy West, welcome to Fresh Air. I thought we'd begin with a clip from the reemergence of Futurama, because this features some of your voices. And this is, I think, just about at the very beginning of episode one. Let's give a listen here.
Professor, my fry fro is all frizzy.
Okay.
Well, that's all. Oh, also, I'm covered with severe burns.
So? What of it?
Well, why is those things?
You mean you don't remember?
Nope. Nothing. It's like when I passed out in college, except no one drew magic marker penises on my forehead.
Well, I suppose it's for the best, considering the unbearable horrors you've endured. Let's never speak of it again. It all began a few days ago. We were interstellar fugitives on the run from the law.
Fire all weapons and open a hailing frequency for my victory yodel.
And that's from Futurama. Three voices by our guest, Billy West. Zap Brannigan was the last.
Sometimes there's
more. Oh, yeah.
Sometimes, you know, like a lot of times I'll be just reading character one after the other. And sometimes it'll be like three or four pages that where I'm talking to myself.
Are you doing that in real time, or do you do it? You tape it and do all of your characters at once?
It happens mostly in real time. Like if there's a run within an act, and there is, say, three characters involved that I do, and then there's some others that other people do, I'll just keep reading through the script, you know, one character, and then if another one pops up, I do that in real time, and we try to get a whole scene.
So in that case, you're going from Professor Farnsworth to Philip J. Fry to Zap Brannigan, just one after the other.
Yes.
Right, well, let's talk a little bit about these characters, since some of the audience, it's been a while since some people in the audience may have heard the series. Some may not be so familiar. Let's talk a little bit about these characters. And why don't you just tell us a little bit about the character and how you came up with the voice? Philip J. Fry first.
Man, all this constant exposure to radiation is making me thirsty. His voice is basically what I sounded like when I was 25, kind of plain vanilla. I had nothing special about my voice, really. And I just thought, well, you know what? I know that character so well. And if I do this and it is kind of what I sounded like, it's very hard to replace that character like with somebody else. Because, you know, somebody can imitate an exaggeration or more cartoony, but to try to do somebody else's sort of real voice is really tough.
All right, so let's talk about another one, Professor Farnsworth. Tell us about his voice and the character that he is.
Professor Hubert J. Farnsworth. He's 147-year-old.
You know, he kind of zones in and out. And,
good news, everyone. Bad news.
He's doddering, and he's a combination of lots of different wizards and, you know, Burgess Meredith and Frank Morgan and all those kind of things all kind of rolled up into one.
Now, there's Zoidberg. Tell us what Zoidberg looks like, too, and give us his voice.
Zoidberg is sort of a fleshy, sort of orange color, and he has a lot of, like, tentacle things hanging from his mouth. That is his mouth. And he's a crustacean, and he's got claws, and he wears like almost Dr. White's, or, you know, intern White's for clothes, and he wears sandals for some reason. And he's poor, and he's a doctor. That's what I love the best about him. He's poor. You know, he's always like, you know, Zoidberg Cavite. Yeah, it's,
hooray, I'm popular.
That voice, you know.
Yeah, where
like,
did that voice come from?
Young lady, bring me a sandwich from the dumpster and leave the maggots on it.
It's a combination of a couple of people in show business that I always found really funny and interesting, and they were what I used to describe as marble mouth.
Uh-huh. And who guys. Are they? Can you tell us?
One was from vaudeville. I don't know if anybody remembers the word vaudeville or what it actually means, but it was theater. And there was a performer back in those days named George Jessel.
Of course.
And he was the Toastmaster General of the United States, you know, and he would always have, you know, appropriate toasts for every occasion. I don't know how that makes you famous or anything, but he had kind of a marble mouth, and he used to do a routine on stage, like talking to his mother, you know, from show business. He's out on the road, and he's like, hello, Mama. Yes, it's your son, George. From the money each week? You know, like, in other words, right. Who? And the other guy was an actor by the name of Lou Jacoby. He was in the movie Arthur. And he said, well, he's in tons of movies, but he's in the movie Arthur, and he said to Arthur, what's it like having all that money? And he was in, you know, he was in The Diary of Anne Frank, and I thought it was so impactive and so horrendous and everything, but the casting, they cast Ed Wynn as the head of the household, and then they hired Lou Jacoby to play the Uncle Buddy. And they're going through this horrible thing trying to hide from Nazis. And Uncle Buddy was, like, taking more than his share of the little bit of rations they had. So Ed Wynn had to yell at him. But they're two comic actors. And I used to sort of snicker. And I'm going to smack myself. And I go, no, this is crazy. You can't. This looks in the horrible story this is. But he'd be like, here all along we thought it was the rats, Buddy, and it was you. And he'd go,
I stole from the children. I'm sorry that I stole from the children.
You know, and it's just, I'm sorry, but the next time you watch it, please don't laugh on my account.
All right. Well, we'll try and maintain some decorum for the subject.
It's horrible.
Do
that
you
I
combine
even brought that up?
Do you combine voices a lot to get something that you like? I mean, do you
you're
like somebody
fusions.
In a laboratory just putting, you know, I don't know, Jackie Gleason and, you know, whoever together?
Yes, those are great things. Doing impressions is one thing, but it's not like you bring a whole lot to it except your skill for mimicry. But if you take certain aspects, like different people in showbiz periphery, and you fuse them together, you come up with these amalgams of characters, and they kind of take on their own life. You know, I've done that with a lot of things.
Yeah, can you think of another example of that?
Another example of that. The character Zap Brannigan was based on a lot of disc jockeys I grew up with, like, because I worked in radio.
Right,
now,
let's for the audience. I was going to get to him next. Zap Brannigan is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's a character in Futurama. Just explain who he is, and then where we can hear that voice. Yeah.
Zap Brannigan is a character on Futurama. He's a starship captain, and it would be like if William Shatner ran the Enterprise and not, you know, James T. Kirk, and he has that kind of pompousness.
Right.
And he's got a voice that. I listened to disc jockeys. I used to work with them. I mean, they were some of them were the old days guys that were phasing out, and they carried their temerity in a wheelbarrow, and they loved far and away above everything else in the world the sound of their own voice, and they'd be like, you know, coming to the Worcester Centrum, meh, you know, they would never let it go. It had to have this hamburger helper in it, you know, just because they wanted to swing with every pitch and fill the air with their sound. All right, in about 5 minutes, it's coming up on 8 o'clock, and 5 minutes after 8, it'll be 5:08 on all-time radio. You know, those kind of guys were part of it. And then I loved the big, dumb announcers from the old days, too, who, you know, their voice sounded like the last voice of the world, but it almost became comical.
Well, like what were they like, the big, dumb announcers of the old days? What do you mean?
Well, you know, the old guys that were on the radio would come in and go, friends, you know what you and I need? Really need? A good cup of coffee. And that's where Cava comes in. It's got no caffeine. you know, they would meander. And I loved that. So Zap Brannigan was like, this is Zap Brannigan, master of time, space, and everything else in the universe. And, winner of this year's Modesty Award.
Yeah, he is a lot of fun in this. And he reminds me of Phil Hartman somehow. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, you know what it was, is Phil Hartman was really supposed to do that. And they wanted him. And I met Phil Hartman before he passed. And we did talk about we had a commonality, which was the love of those big, dumb announcers from the old days.
You know, Futurama, it was on Fox for, I guess, 5 seasons, right? And then gone from television for a long time. Did you think it would return?
Yeah, I did, because it was too good to not be on television. You know, it was the most enjoyable thing I had ever been involved with, and I would have been a fan of it even if I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, what's special about it?
Well, the writing is what gets me. It's just very, very unusual. It's turns humor kind of upside down, and it comes out scrambled, but it's really funny. Like somebody would say to Fry, "Hey, Fry, I heard your beer makes you stupid." And he goes, "Norm doesn't." You know, that's the stuff that knocks me on my rear end.
And I should tell folks that in one of these episodes, the head of President Nixon appears. I assume that's your voice?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. He's it's Nixon's head. He's the president of Earth in the future, 3000. He got to be president of Earth. And he would say same kind of stuff he said back then, like,
"Look it out in front of the White House, all those filthy hippies."
You know, and I would do that werewolf kind of noise, like, because I was a kid when Nixon was debating Kennedy on television, and we got to watch it, and on one side, here's this GQ model with that buttered toast, perfect game show hair, you know, and then there's this sweaty mess with jowls and a 5 o'clock shadow that came in at 2 o'clock and sweating and, you know, and so I said to my mom, it looks like he's going to turn into a werewolf, you know, because it was like Larry Talbot turning into the werewolf, you know, and that's what it looked like to me. So that's why I gave him that sort of thing. Everybody said, why does he say Aru? Why? And I said, well, it's just a thing of my own that I threw in there.
You know, you've been doing voices for so long, and you have tremendous technique. And I'm wondering how much of getting a character is technical, and how much of it is just doing that, just getting a feeling and rolling with it?
It's all of those that you just mentioned. Most of all, it's in the head. You have to have some kind of power of observation, almost like a trained observer. And you watch people and study them the way an alien would. I know I always did that when I was a kid, and it's not because I was cynical and I'm looking to just figure everybody out. It just came so very natural to me, and then I would, you know, it would come out of me in one way or the other, whether I was singing or just so many things that would stay in my head. I think it's also the kind of an ear a voice performer has, where they're able to hear things in real life that other people can't hear, and they grab a hold of it and then amplify it either through another character or a direct impression. But the throat just kind of falls into line once you realize in your head what it is. You got to remember the musicality of a character that you're going to do. In other words, like Yogi Bear, I mean, if the guy who did it, he did about 120 voices in some of those shows, Dawes Butler. And I think with him is he would remember the cadence, the melody of the character, like, and then fall into Yogi Bear, not just trying to dial it up on the spot. And he would remember that the character is like, like Art Carney or something. And then he would remember, you know, to apply that cadence to this character, and all of a sudden he could go into it, you know.
So there's like a song that everybody carries with them, right? A melody and a cadence, or you find that?
Yeah, I would think, if I think of Zap Brannigan and I think of da 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 da, and the professor would be like, ooh, you know, not particularly a tune, but just this cadence.
Well, I wanted to talk about some of the other work you've done. You know, in addition to creating a lot of characters, you have recreated a lot of, you know, the famous, you know, Warner Brothers characters, the Mel Blanc characters from the 40s.
Yes.
How does that compare? Because, I mean, there you're dealing with an expectation that people have been trained to, you know, to listen to for years and years. You got to get it exactly right.
Yeah. Well, like you just said, it's all about perception. Exactly right to one person is not exactly right to another person that's listening. Because you got to remember there was like four different Bugs Bunnies depending on who directed the cartoons. There was a real wisecracker Bugs Bunny, you know, early on in the 40s. And then as he moved towards the 50s, he got a little cuter and he got more clever and was not so feral. And then by the 60s, he spent most of his wildness just outsmarting Daffy with words rather than antics.
Okay, so what's your Bugs Bunny?
Mine was somewhere in the 50s and late 40s. And when I did Space Jam, I got to work with the closest thing to a religious figure that we have, Doc, Michael Jordan. I got paid $1 million, a carrot at a time. And I also got hired to do Elmer Fudd. And recently there was this commercial running for Geico Insurance. And it was a Mel Blanc, not Mel Blanc, Elmer Fudd coming through, you know, into the cartoon woods with his shotgun. And he's like, he does his usual, you know, shh, be very, very quiet. I'm hunting wabbits. And the director comes in, he goes, Elmer, that's rabbits? Wabbits. Rabbits? Wabbits. You know, and the director gives up on him, and Elmer Fudd walks away mortified, and he goes, this director is starting to rub me the wrong way.
You also did Popeye in a film like a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, it was a Fox, it was CGI animation, the first time they ever did that with Popeye. I thought it was pretty good. But of course, you know, there are the diehard Popeye people that were mortified and wanted to die because it became CGI. And but nobody had a bad thing to say about my performance. I loved Jack Mercer, and I got him, you know, I understood him, and what helped me understand that Popeye voice, it's a high voice and a low voice at the same time. Because when I was a kid, we all used to try to do that, and they all stunk, you know, it just didn't sound right.
Right.
So one day I see this film, it was an independent film called Genghis Blues. And it was about this blind singer in San Francisco. He wrote a hit for Steve Miller called Big Old Jet Airliner. His name was Paul Pena. And he was listening to a world band radio one night. He was blind, and he used to just go across the continents listening to different things, and he heard this strange noise. And it was a program about Tuvan singers. And Tuvans had a way of singing where they could do, like, one and two voices. And all of a sudden he hears, you know, excuse me, like Popeye. I have to get ready for those things. But anyway, I realized, oh, my God, that's how this guy did it. Maybe without realizing it, Jack Mercer would be like, yoo-hoo, olive oil, I bring you some flowers. And then the other voice would be like, yoo-hoo, olive oil, I bring you some flowers. You know, they're like an octave apart. And then all of a sudden together would be like, yoo-hoo, olive oil, I bring you some flowers.
Here's a scene from a recent episode of Futurama in which Starship Captain Zap Brannigan is summoned by the preserved and reanimated head of Richard Nixon, both characters played by Billy West. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Mr. President, what the hell?
At ease, Brannigan. What you're about to see is highly classified. Reptilicus, hit the thingy. At 0000 hours, Planet X-3 was attacked by a mysterious death sphere.
Magnify that death sphere. Why is it still blurry?
That's all the resolution we have. Making it bigger doesn't make it clearer.
It does on CSI Miami.
Ugh.
They fought back with advanced military hardware, but it was like shooting BBs at Baby Rebozo.
That poor, brave hardware.
The sphere then fired some kind of hellish blackout ray. Erase that planet like 18 minutes of incriminating tape.
Oh, I just wish I understood why. Why I should care.
Because the Death Sphere is now on course for Earth.
You know, it's hard to believe it's been, I think, 15 years since you were on the Howard Stern show. You were a regular for several years. And I know I remember you on that show, and a lot of people do. And I thought we could listen to just a little bit of this. One of the things you...
This is going to polarize people.
Well, we'll see what people think. I mean, one of the things you would do, you did a lot of voices, and sometimes you would do a celebrity who was actually being interviewed on the show while he was on the show and say things that the celebrity would never say. And I thought we'd just listen to a little bit. This is when they were beginning an interview with George Takei, who was Mr. Sulu from Star Trek, the Japanese-American actor. And in this particular case, they're dialing him up. He's not in the studio. He's, I guess, hooked up by satellite. And you're in the studio with Howard Stern and his others, all prepared to do the George Takei voice as he does it. Let's just listen to how this gets started.
Hello?
Hello.
Ah, George, my old friend.
Hello. How are you, Howard?
Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. I've been listening in on you all this time with all the buzz and beeps and squeaks. What are you doing there?
Hey, by the way, I have George Takei Jr. here. Say hello, George.
Warp Factor 2. Yeah. All those beeps and squeaks.
And who is that?
That is your long-lost brother.
My long-lost brother. You know, remember in the next Star me? Trek movie, Star Trek Generations, about the next generation... They've got my daughter working on the helm.
You know what? Have a deep
I didn't
daughter.
Know about her.
Yeah.
Someone just told me.
I'm sick of rice.
Hey, George, you know, it's funny.
So you're not in the new movie.
No, I'm not. My daughter is.
Oh. Hey, George.
Yes.
Yes. Stop it, because I'll never get through this interview.
Right, I'm A.C. Takei.
Right. A.C.
All right, take it easy.
O.J.
All right, stop it.
And that's our guest, Billy West, from his old days on the Howard Stern Show. Bring back some memories?
Yes. It just went by so fast, it was like a blur, you know, because nothing was scripted. It was pretty much organic, and I was facilitated by a writer that was there in the room, a stand-up comedian named Jackie Martling, who was brilliant, you know, writing stuff for Howard and... Howard was gracious enough to loan me that nuclear weapon when I was doing characters with Jackie facilitating. But, yeah, whatever was going on, you'd work off of it, you know.
Some of the other characters we just got to go over. Larry Fine, the Three Stooges member that everybody forgets. You did a lot with Larry Fine.
Well, I just thought he was so deliciously peripheral. And the little that he did used to... blow me away. He was the stooge in the middle. He really didn't have a whole lot to say. It was Moe and Curly always doing number on each other, and Larry would be in the corner. But every now and then he'd go, "Be careful, Moe. You know, what's the matter with this Christmas tree? Hey, Moe, you put too much tinsel on the Christmas tree." "No, I didn't." It's just the stupid stuff that he said. "Hey, Moe, I peed on my shoe." "Hey, Moe, I broke your Pesach dishes." "Why, you idiot. This is the meat. This is the dairy."
You've done so many voices over the years, and people generally don't know what you look like. I mean, I don't know what Mel Blanc looked like, really. Does that visual anonymity appeal to you? I mean, do you feel like you don't quite get your due now?
No, I mean, I don't worry about that. You know, as long as I can apply my craft, I'm happy. I have no more of an agenda than somebody who wants to bring something to the table. You know, I mean, it's just I'm closer to being an artist because I was always that. Even when I was coming through school, I was a loner, and I used to study music and listen to it and play it, and I was in bands, and it was more about I just wanted to do something cool.
You know, I wanted just to come back to your childhood again a bit. I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but... You know, I've read that you had a tough childhood. I mean, your dad was abusive in your early years, right?
Yes.
And did you do voices back then? Was it a way of escaping or helping, you know, boost your mom's spirits?
Well, yes, I did. My mom particularly. But the problem here was is my dad was an overgrown kid, you know, alcoholic, abusive, kind of crazy, really. And he had talent. He could do voices and dialects. And he could sit down at a piano, having never played one, and start playing. And whenever I would try to do something like that, I'd get laughed out the door. You know, so it was kind of a real traumatic thing to go through is, you know,
you mean
like
he
trying
could,
to...
He could do it, but he didn't want you doing it?
Well, it wasn't like he wanted me doing it. He would be dismissive, you know, or make it like it was nothing. And I grew up thinking all the things I could do was nothing, like a parlor trick. You know, I never had a sense of entitlement about it. I used to kind of keep it hid like an appendix scar. And then when I was 21, I started drinking, and I began to have a real childhood then. And I busted loose with all the stuff that I was able to do.
And you eventually overcame that.
Oh, yeah. I was in, you know, bands. It was kind of part and parcel to that situation that you would you'd be drinking and doing drugs and everything. But 26 years ago, I just stopped everything. And it's been fine, and I've been lucky enough to get the kind of work that I get.
You know, you said that when you were little and you would do these things, which and you clearly had a gift, but it was dismissed and you didn't, it wasn't valued. When did that change? When did you see it as something that you know, that had my, value?
Well, my mom always thought that I had something special, and she would keep reminding me of it because I didn't fit in the towny world we lived in. I couldn't play sports. I was not antisocial. I was just kind of smarter. But my mom did encourage stuff for the most part. And, you know, like when I was a little kid, we went to lunch and we were sitting in some cafeteria. It might have been like a soda fountain or some little cafeteria. And I heard this noise coming from the corner of the room, this like, and I was going out of my mind. I had to find out what it was. And it was a guy who had a Bell Telephone artificial larynx. And I asked my mom, "Mom, what is that?" And she said, "He's got like a voice box, electronic voice box." Why? Because he probably had cancer and he had his voice box removed. And the sound haunted me. And, you know, so when I was a little kid, I felt it was my duly deputized duty to find a way to reproduce stuff like that.
Well, Billy West, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Vocal artist Billy West does several characters on Futurama, which airs on Comedy Central Thursday nights at 9. You can hear Billy do an expanded Fresh Air intro and see three scenes from Futurama at our website, freshair.npr.com. That's .org. It may surprise you to learn that there are tens of thousands of Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades, a flourishing population that has naturalists worried because they're making meals of dozens of small animals native to the region. The pythons were introduced into Florida as pets, and they're among several exotic animals that our next guest, Peter Laufer, says humans have taken on as companions. In his new book, Laufer says far more Americans than we know are bringing snakes, lions, tigers, monkeys, and chimpanzees into their homes, sometimes with tragic consequences. Peter Laufer has written 12 books. His latest is Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. Well, Peter Laufer, welcome to Fresh Air. A lot of this book is about when and why and whether humans can own really unusual animals in a mutually safe and beneficial way. And you open the book with one of the most troubling cautionary tales. Tell us the story of Sandra Harold and her chimpanzee, Travis.
Sandra Harold's story and the story of her chimpanzee, Travis, really became quite a cause célèbre because Travis, the chimpanzee, who had been living in suburban Stamford, Connecticut, in Sandra Harold's home for years, ran amok when she attempted to get him back into his cage in his room and needed some help, called on her friend Sharla Nash, who had helped her before as an employee with the chimpanzee. And when Sharla Nash arrived at her property in Stamford, the chimpanzee attacked her. And there is a horrific 911 call that she makes to attempt to summon the police and eventually successfully, during which she's describing this attack that left Sharla Nash maimed. And in fact, just recently, two events occurred that are in some ways the culmination of this whole sorry episode. Sharla Nash finally, after over a year, was released from the hospital. And in the same week, Sandra Harrell died, her friends suggesting that she died of heartbreak. The chimpanzee, once it attacked and almost killed Sharla Nash, was shot by the police who finally came and then ran off into the woods bleeding. They followed that bloody trail that circled back into the house, into his room in the house, into the cage that was in his room in the house where he died lying on his bloodied bedding.
You know, and at the risk of lending a little too much graphic detail to this, describe some of the injuries that the chimp inflicted on Sharla Nash.
She lost hands. Her face was literally torn off. And the fact that she survived at all is miraculous. That she's out of the hospital and rebuilding her life is a real testimonial to the human spirit.
Now, Sandra Harrell said that this attack was completely out of character for her chimpanzee, Travis. Describe their relationship, that is to say, Sandra, the owner of the chimp, and the chimp himself.
Closest way to describe it, I think, would be that of a mother and child, and that's the way she described it. She lost her own child not long before this occurred and her husband, and announced the chimpanzee as the only family that she had left. In her home, she had the primitive drawings of the chimpanzee tacked up on the refrigerator, the way you might have the drawings of your children displayed. And she was somewhat notorious for sleeping with the chimpanzee and sharing a glass of wine in a stemmed glass with the chimpanzee at cocktail hour. The chimpanzee had a history of being trained for commercial work, a way that she was able to make some extra money, and was known around town because periodically they would venture out together.
Do we have any idea why Travis the chimpanzee reacted as he did in this case?
He was nervous, and she was concerned about that. Apparently she gave him some kind of sedative to try to calm him down, and that did not work. Why exactly that day he ran amok is unknown, but that he ran amok is not necessarily surprising, because throughout the history of this kind of private ownership of chimpanzees, there is a perpetual similar story that occurs, which is once these cute, cuddly animals go through adolescence, they manifest behavior that is no longer the kind that you would like to enjoy as a pet running around your living room. And most of the private owners of chimpanzees, if not all of them, I'm trying to think right now, and I can't think of one that I encountered that didn't do this, once the animals pass through adolescence, they're kept caged. They no longer run free in the household or in the yards.
How do people get these chimps and monkeys? Are there? Do you go online and get ads which seduce you and say, oh, you know, you'll never have more fun than you will with these cute little guys?
Yeah, it's not even that much of a seduction because there's enough of a marketplace, but you can go online and search tiger for sale, lion for sale, monkey for sale. You can also look through a newspaper that is oriented toward those who seek exotic pets. You can go to a state like Missouri where, although the laws are changing, it's basically unrestricted, the ownership of animals of any kind. And you can go to a place, as I did, like the Lolly Brothers Exotic Auction in Macon, Georgia, and spend a couple of days. These auctions happen a few times a year, and you can buy yourself a camel, or you can buy yourself a Z-donk, which is a breed, a crossbreed of a donkey and a zebra. You can buy yourself a serval or some other cat. You can buy yourself any number of monkeys.
So you can go and bid on a camel, and if you're the winner, just write it right off the lot?
If you know how to ride your camel, I guess, and if you're, there's some place you want to go. But yes, the yard is full of trailers, and camels were big the day that I was there. One after another, these amazing animals that are captive bred here in this country and are put up for sale by the breeders to those who would like to have a camel instead of a kitty or a doggy.
You know, we should talk a little bit about the law and regulation that affects these creatures. And I know that in addition, we've talked some about monkeys and about chimps, and you visited a lot of people who own big cats, lions and tigers. Let's just look at the law. If I want to buy a tiger cub or a chimp and keep it in my yard, is that legal?
Well, one of the problems that exists for those who think that there should be restriction is the fact that we have a patchwork of laws around the country. So that would depend on where you live. If you live in Texas and several other states, I'm just picking Texas now for this answer, then sure, you can have a tiger in your yard, and it's nobody's business any more than it would be if you had any other animal. The laws differ state to state. Sometimes there are local and regional laws that are much more severe than the state laws. There are no overarching federal laws to prevent you from having an exotic pet. The trend seems to be for more and more restrictive statewide laws, making it more difficult for people to freewheelingly keep these kinds of animals.
So there's no federal ban, for example, on interstate commerce or transportation?
No, that's different.
That's different.
Interstate,
okay.
Yes. And that's where we get into the complexity. The Lacey Act kicks in, which has a jurisdiction over that kind of interstate movement of the animals. If, of course, the animal is an endangered species or a threatened species, then it's an entirely different situation. So if you were to somehow get a smuggled wild tiger from India, then you would be violating international law and U.S. federal law. But if you were to have a captive bred tiger that was bred, for example, in Texas, or if you decided to go into the tiger breeding business in Texas, then these restrictions would not be there for you. And in fact, one of the great cocktail party circuit statistics that I found popping eyes when I first started researching this project is that all indications are that there are many more tigers in Texas than there are in India. The tigers in Texas are captive bred. The tigers in India are wild. Many more in Texas.
Now, one of the things, I know that you spend a lot of time talking to people who own big cats like tigers and lions. And if I recall one of these people saying to you, you know, there are people that are bitten by dogs every year. I think the statistic you quote in 2007, something like 80,000 dog bites a year that require hospitalization. And somebody said, well, you know, you can't name me a single case of a captive tiger having killed anyone.
And it's an intriguing way to look at it. Those who are proponents of this lifestyle and of this relationship, and it's important to point out that they are passionate about the value that the animals bring to their lives and the value that they believe they bring to the animals' lives. And the numbers are, in fact, in their favor. Sure, the Centers for Disease Control dog bite register is phenomenal. And the number of fatalities, let alone attacks from big cats or great apes or the long snakes, and there have been some dramatic snake attacks in the last few years. Burmese pythons have run rampant in the Everglades and throughout Florida, causing problems. But yes, that is an interesting argument, that statistically it's way over the top on the domesticated animals causing problems.
And of course, there are millions of dogs out there as opposed to a few thousand
of course.
Tigers.
Of course.
But did these pet owners regard these animals as dangerous at all? I mean, did they believe that although they might have 364 good days with them, on the last day they might turn aggressive and be dangerous?
Sure. And I think that that is perhaps, as I try to analyze the motivation on some level, part of the intrigue. A lot of us do things that could turn sour easily, whether it is going too fast on the highway or skydiving or whatever it is we choose to do. And I think that the combination of the fact that they are anthropomorphized, even the cats, maybe not the snakes, and that they are unusual and that they draw attention to the owners, combined with that reality that something may not work right, or maybe more than that something may not work right, it's that, look what I'm able to do. You're afraid of this. It could kill you. It could kill me, but it's not going to kill me because it loves me.
And you get a couple of close call stories to tell over cocktails or barbecue that must be a lot of fun.
There are the close call stories, but the ones that do work at the cafe or the bar are the really sobering ones, and that's when it goes, as you just mentioned, so sour after so many times of everything being okay. And I think about the woman who was cleaning the cage of the multiple hundred-pound bear that she had raised from a cub, and she always did the same thing. And that particular day, her kids were watching as she threw the dog food over on one side of the cage to attract the bear, and she went in to clean up the cage, and the bear decided that she looked more interesting than the dog food, and he killed her there in view of her children and was starting to come out toward them when a neighbor killed the bear. And this is a horrific reality. And then again, it goes back to your set of statistics, and that is how many dogs kill how many people versus how many bears kill how many people in a year in this country.
You know, looking at this sort of with a broader lens, I mean, it seems like you don't find a lot to admire in this proliferation of wild animals in being owned and cared for by people across the country. But you talk to so many people who have these wild animals in their possession. Was there one of them who came closest to making a case to you that this is kind of okay or worth it, or that you saw a relationship between the owner and the pet that seemed, I don't know, in some way uniquely valuable?
Well, I think about a couple in Pahrump, Nevada. They're seen, as odd as it was for me, because it so out of character for my norms, looked like everybody was living happily ever after. They were far from neighbors. They had a lot of acreage. The enclosures were clean and relatively big. They were doing things that were completely out of context from my lifestyle. As I was getting directions on my mobile phone from the woman, she said, "I hope you're not going to be grossed out when you get here." And I said, "Why is that?" She said, "Well, we just killed a horse." And I got to their place, and there was a horse hanging from a wood frame being bled out. The horse was going to be destroyed, and different neighbors around where they live know that they need meat. And her partner was busy preparing it for the tigers. He has to skin it because they don't want any hair or skin on it because they were captive bred and they're used to prepared meat. Everybody seemed to be quite happy in that enclosure there. While I was there, the animals were getting the fresh meat. The horse was being disposed of in a manner that seemed better than wasting it. The two of them clearly loved their animals. I don't want to move in with them and become a roommate, but I think the criteria there meets yours.
Well, Peter Lawford, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
Peter Lawford's book is Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. You can read a chapter at our website, freshair.npr.org.